Hello, this is Loretta Bertillon at the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum, and I'm recording for the Tulsans Talk program. It is September 6, 2023, and I'm sitting here with a lady of history. This is Winnie Perdue. Winnie, what is your whole name?
Winnie Mae Guess is my maiden name, Perdue.
Okay. When were you born, Winnie?
I was born November 5th, 1937.
Okay. Now,
so I'll be 86. I'll do the math for you. I'll be 86 this November in about a month.
Okay.
Month and a half.
Okay. Well, you're going to be telling some things about the Cherokee Nation. Do you have a Cherokee name?
You know, I have a name that my dad would call me, Justu, which is rabbit. And he also had then an English name for me, which was Lady. And the reason he called me Lady was because my mother would take me to the Methodist circle meetings, and I was never left with a sitter. That was unheard of, really, and I was an only child. And she would take a little rocker that he had made for me, and I would sit in the little rocker and never say a word and never move. And so because of that, he always called me Lady, because they could take me any place and I would behave.
So we've got your birthday. Why don't you just start with your story?
Okay. Sure.
I'll just let you lead this.
Okay. Well, as I said, I am Winnie Mae Guess Perdue, and I am designated culture keeper of Cherokee Nation. I am a proud enrolled citizen of the Cherokee Nation. I now am considered a groundbreaking, one of the first women fancy dancers. And the Cherokee Nation, about 5 or 6 years ago, named me one of 5 women who changed the world. And I was keeping very good company with our chief, Wilma Mankiller, and Nanya He, who is a beloved woman of Cherokee Nation. So that's probably the greatest honor I have ever received. And I'll start back with my father. And this is long before Oklahoma became a state. So we're Indian Territory, and he's on our original allotment with his family. And they were very prosperous, had cattle and farming. And this was right over past No Head Hollow outside of Tahlequah. And both of his parents probably succumbed to tuberculosis, because the natives had no natural immunity to that. And they were grieving. He and his siblings were grieving the loss of their parents. And one morning, there was dust on the road, and they knew someone was coming to their place, and a wagon came up, and it was the Indian agent. And he said that the oldest daughter should get all the family belongings together, family Bible and a bit of clothing, because they were going to come pick them up the following day, because now they're orphans. And that was, of course, alarming to them.
This is your father's family.
Yes. Uh-huh. And My aunt Sarah was the oldest, and she was maybe 14. My daddy was the youngest. And she took those instructions and began to get everything ready for them to come and pick them up the following day, because they were going to do what was said. Well, my Uncle Willie was the oldest. He was about 17, oldest fellow, and he ran away that night. He did not want to succumb to that. So they followed the instructions. The wagon came and picked him up the following day and took them into Tahlequah and outside of Tahlequah to the Sequoia Indian Training School. That's what it was called. It previously had been established as a Cherokee asylum. They called it Insane Asylum. But they changed it right away after only, I'm going to say, like 2 years, because there was no one to go there. So that tells us a little bit about living in nature, living with nature, having a respect for the land and for the country. Our people had that, and we were very secure in it. So we found we did not need the asylum, but they changed it to an orphanage. And so my daddy and his sisters were there, and they were punished for speaking Cherokee. And that was the only language they knew. They were first speakers. They were punished for that. So they had to try to learn. My Aunt Nanny and Aunt Sarah and Aunt Jenny would visit us and tell us that they would wait until night and the lights were out in the dorm. And then they would, of course, speak to each other in Cherokee. And you know, a sad thing, my daddy, see, was the only boy and the youngest. So they were waiting for the lights to go out so that they could speak, and my daddy just had to wait. He had no one to talk to.
Because he's in a different dorm.
Yes, he's in the boys' dorm.
Okay.
And he was fearful. It was not his family.
What year are we talking, Winnie?
Oh, goodness, this was, like I say, before statehood. Oh, my. I'd have to think about that.
Do you know when your family came to Oklahoma?
Oh, no. Oh, no. There are no records of that or anything. And, you know, my daddy, I'm glad you brought that up. My daddy doesn't, you know, none of his family had a birth certificate because they were born in Indian Territory. And what we do know is that we are direct descendants of Sequoia. My father is a great-great-grandson of Sequoia. So we know that Sequoia went to Arkansas and settled there before the removal, because he was quite a visionary, and they considered him a genius at that time, having, you know, written the alphabet. And he could see that this was coming, that removal was coming, and he came ahead. Like I say, of quite a visionary, and he came to Arkansas. So all those dates are lost to the ages. No, there is no record, and without birth certificates, you know, official birth certificates and those kinds of things, that was something that was unheard of at the time.
Do you think Sequoia came to Arkansas before the removal?
Yes, he did.
Maybe close to it, because they knew it was coming.
Yes, prior to.
Okay, so we can get a general
idea. Yes,
then.
Because
okay.
he was part of the contingency that would go travel to Washington and make the case. You know, he was involved in all that, and he realized from his standpoint that it was ultimately going to happen. You know, of course, Andrew Jackson was no friend of the Cherokee, and because of his removal policies, it became apparent that that was what was going to happen, because they actually had gone through all the legalities. And see, a lot of people don't realize that Cherokee were highly educated at that time. We were educating our young men in the universities back east then. So we were able to tell our story, negotiate, do everything. And there was a document that had enough signatures that the president should have recognized. And he then said, let them enforce it. And the removal took place. So I guess you would say it was part of the manifest destiny that they would move forward. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, so Sequoia, having been involved in all that, been part of the delegation, he realized it was coming, you know. And he was quite a thinker, because later I did a PBS special that was University of Oklahoma and I believe University of Georgia partnered on that. And we traveled to Sarasota, Mexico, and we filmed a documentary searching for Sequoia. And at that point, Sequoia had walked from Arkansas to Mexico.
Okay,
and he died there. Uh-huh. And of course, they have always been seeking his final resting place.
I saw that documentary. That's been in the last few years.
Yes, okay. Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. We went there, I'm going to say about 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was remarkable to trace that. And that has always given me so much encouragement. My father and my mother both expected, they had a high expectation. The bar was set high for me. And again, I was an only child. My daddy's purebred Cherokee. And he worked as a translator for BIA much mm-hmm. of his life. And I'll return to that original story. So there they are at Sequoia in Tahlequah, and all of them graduated. He and his sisters all graduated and went on to Haskell Institute, and so college educated. All my aunts became teachers, and my daddy was a translator for the BIA, and we moved to Pryor, Oklahoma, and that's where we were. And so life happened, and we were separated as a family from my aunts, but they would travel every other year. They'd come from California and Salt Lake City. They were all teaching at Indian schools. Uh-huh. And so that was another facet. And the interesting part of it, when I was enrolled at Northeastern in Tahlequah, and my daddy, I was packing, getting ready to go, and he said, "Winnie, you will always walk in two worlds." And I always have.
He saw your future.
Oh, yes, yes. They, again, their expectation was high. So I'm a freshman at Northeastern, and I'm the first week or so, we walked into town, and right there in front of the Cherokee headquarters were a couple of old fellas who were whittling, and you know, Cherokee men, and one of them called to me, "Winnie, Winnie," and I was like, "My Uncle Willie."
The one that was separated early?
He's the one that ran away.
Uh-huh.
And we had never really been in touch with him because he had run to the hills and remained there. He did not speak English. And he had recognized me because I had appeared, you know, at the Cherokee Holiday, which at that time, I was there the years before it was even designated and called Cherokee Holiday, and I would dance there, you know, and perform. But it kind of lets you know, my daddy was telling me that I would be walking in two worlds, and there and there I found my Uncle Willie, who had always walked in one.
Was he at the Cherokee Courthouse there in Tahlequah, right there on Main Street?
Yeah, in the headquarters.
I remember when
the,
I was
young,
benches
there.
And especially on Saturdays, there
yes.
was always
oh,
a gathering
yes.
of the natives.
That's exactly the site.
Mm-hmm. And most of them were speaking Cherokee.
Oh, sure, uh-huh. sure. And my daddy and his family, his sisters, they always spoke Cherokee when they visited, you know. But because their visits were few and because, then my father, the war happened, and my father was too old to be in the draft early on and with a family. So we moved to Tulsa, and he worked at the he was at the powder plant in Pryor initially, and then he came to work in Tulsa at the ammunition. And so I lived in Tulsa for a brief time. I started school in Tulsa. I have an interesting quick story about that. First day of school, My mother was a school teacher, I have to tell you, in a one-room school outside of Pahrump, between Pahrump and Warner, Oklahoma. That's all Cherokee country and allotments down there. And she was teaching the Cherokee students English, and they were teaching her Cherokee. So we had a lot of educators in my family. And I go to school the first day, and they're very eager to hear about it. So we're having dinner, and my daddy said, "Well, Winnie, how was your first day of school?" And I said, "Oh, I got put back." And they thought, well, she's in kindergarten. If she got put back, she's been sent home. My mother accompanied me to school the following day. We went to the principal's office, and he said, "Oh, no, Miss Guess, she was put up. She's put up. So she's in a new room today. She's in first grade, and I'll just walk you down there. We'll just walk down there together and meet the new teacher and everything, because she was put up yesterday." And I'm not knowing. And so we go in, and the teacher's, "Oh, Winnie, we're looking for you. Okay, that's great." My mother's aside talking with the principal, you know, just sharing the day. And the teacher said to me, So, what is your last name? I want to put you in alpha order." I said, "Guess."
Oh.
The teacher, you know, said, she was humoring me, and she said, "Oh, now that's good. Okay. Well," and see, I was only five, barely five. She said, "Oh, that's good. Okay, now I'm going to be seating everyone here, so I'll have a way to keep track of all you students. So now, what is your last name? Guess." Well, about that time, my mother and the principal kind of thought, you know, what's going on? And I'll never forget, still in my mind, the teacher bent forward and said, "Now, you are now in first grade. We do not play guessing games." She was getting irate. And, of course, the principal rushed up and said, "Oh, no, her name is Guess." And probably that day started me off on, I realized I became an instant in the room, a new room to me. I became an instant celebrity. Either one, they thought I was being impudent and, you know, asking the teacher to guess my name, or they realized that there is so much value and power in words. And so I have always had my voice. I've always felt that I had a platform. And I've always been an ambassador for Cherokee Nation. That, you know, that set me in motion. So we moved to Muskogee, and there in Muskogee, I had the most unique journey, because all the leaders of the town, our dentist, our lawyer, everyone there, doctors, were Indian. And so I had a unique experience as a child, growing up in a place where everybody was Indian, claimed to be
Tahlequah,
Muskogee.
In Muskogee, pardon me, okay.
Or wished they were. What a unique situation is that? So every parade, everything that ever happened, my daddy and I, and as direct descendants of Sequoia, we were a part of it. The Indian Centennial happened when I was about 10, maybe 12, and we rode on a float that Daddy depicted Sequoia on one side of the float, and he was teaching the Bacon student, college students, Cherokee and the syllabary, and on the other end, there were all the Bacon students that were depicted graduating with their mortarboard and gown. So it was, once again, that emphasis on education. And they gave me a large bouquet of roses, and I was sitting at the front of the float. So what an amazing experience. I it was fun to me. We went down and gathered at the parade opening, and I saw lots of people, and they took a picture on a stagecoach. And I mean, what's not to like for a child? Now, with the photographs and the history of it, it's recognized, you know, as something almost of great value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was at that time that I began to study ballet and had an opportunity to perform before Yvonne Chouteau. And she at that time was dancing with the Ballet Russe, one of the five Indian ballerinas. And I did not know it was an audition that my teacher had planned. And she selected me to be her protege and go to New York City and study there. I was already enrolled in the professional children's school. It was going to be a huge thing because, again, my daddy's pureblood Cherokee. He's not going to New York. He's going to stay in our home in Muskogee. My mother certainly wasn't going to let me go by myself, so now we're going to leave. And so that kept preying on my mind, but it was in motion. Everything was in motion. I appeared at our community center for a fundraiser, Milk and Ice Fund, and they had set various segments, and they had the Baycone Indian Club also on the program, and I appeared with them because I was doing Indian ballet and Indian-themed ballet. And I saw the eagle dance and the hoop dance, and I knew that I had to do them. It came over me as a spiritual thing. I knew I had to learn, and my mother began the process of talking with Baycone, trying to find out if someone would teach me. Well, of course, what we did not know, she nor I, no women had ever done those dances, period. And I was a Cherokee. And we didn't do those dances. Those were not our history, our culture. We did stomp dancing, and that was all spiritual and secretive to some degree. In that day, it was a little more open. Finally, through Dick West, he is a renowned artist, and he was the director of art at that time, she was able to locate and contact Jack Ancue, Pureblood Kiowa. And he finally agreed, and I believe now he was a college guy that thought, well, I'll pick up a couple of dollars here teaching this young lady, and she'll never learn it, one. He disclosed that to me later. But the hoop dance was what I was interested in, so I took those lessons in Dick West's studio, and every time I went, which was once a week, I saw Dick West's artwork as it progressed. He would work on it some, you know, and then the following week I'd be there for my lesson and I'd see how those paintings. So I got to observe Dick West's artwork as he was producing it. He became a very good friend of our family due to all of this. And Jack made me promise before the first lesson that I would never disclose that he had taught me. And he also said, you may never, ever perform these in public. And I agreed. Because again, it was something that I knew I had to know. I wanted to know it. So I agreed readily. Well, what he didn't realize was that I had been dancing ballet and highly coordinated for some years then, you know, 4 or 5 years. And I learned all those dances within the first 5 or 6 months. And he asked my parents if I could travel with him and perform at the Okmulgee Powwow. And there we are, breaking his own rules. My parents then, of course, I did not have regalia, and they got busy, got it all together. He borrowed some of it, whatever, and we met him there at the Okmulgee Powwow. That's the first time I ever danced these dances.
What year do you remember? Or about? You were how old?
49, maybe, about okay. 1949.
Okay.
And he was so pleased because we were so, they called us specialty dancers in those days at powwows. You have exhibition dancers now, but in those days they called us specialty dancers. So we performed eagle dance and hoop dance, and see, no one, even men, were not doing hoop dance. You have very few hoop dancers at all because it was so technical and so specific. Everyone did the fancy dancing and war dancing.
What's the purpose of the hoop dance?
It signifies, originally with the New Mexico tribes, it signified a young man going through puberty and becoming a man, and the passing through the hoops was significant of that. And so you see how that was extremely difficult for a young girl to be performing this dance that held such tradition from time immemorial.
I assume that as Jack taught you the steps, he told you the meaning of each part.
No, not that much.
You didn't know
not
the
story. That much. Okay. I mean, I knew that. I learned that later.
Okay.
But yes, because see, again, I promised to never perform them in public. I also said that I would never tell anyone that he was the one. So we performed there. Suddenly, everybody is saying, "Oh my goodness, we've got hoop dancers again." See, hadn't been done in a long time. Nobody was doing it. Eagle dancers. No, again, that's a spirituality of getting messages from the Creator coming down on the wings of those eagles, see? So, again, these are plains dances. I'm a Cherokee. So we were invited. Jack's family was so highly regarded. His father sang and wrote a lot of the songs, these old songs. And so he was instrumental in everything that went on at the Anadarko Indian Expedition. And Jack got us an invitation to do eagle dance and hoop dance there. And so that broke the ground. And I will tell you, everyone camped out. So we met, my parents and I met Jack. And he said, "I'm going to go introduce you to my parents." But now see, we had been dancing for a while then. And so people knew about us, especially his parents. And he knew it was not going to bode well. And so we approached their tent. I'll never forget, his mother was cooking pork chops for their family of probably 35 or something, you know, all in a big, big tent with just cots lined up, you know, old-fashioned army cots lined up. And she was tending those pork chops in the largest iron skillet I'd ever seen. And she never looked up, and she never acknowledged my parents and me. And his dad was seated over talking with some fellows, and we went to him, and he did look up, but they did not acknowledge us. And it was probably at least 2 years before they really even spoke with their own son because of this groundbreaking situation. We continued to perform at Anadarko. He and I had so many opportunities, and we took all of them. My parents always supported it because, and oh, back to the story. So you can see, I changed my mind, and I did not follow that opportunity to dance in New York City and study to be a true ballerina because of this experience that I had, which I'm forever grateful for.
Mm-hmm. Would you have worked with Yvonne Chouteau herself, or is that
yes.
a little bit?
Yes, okay. And I would have been at the school. So, quite an opportunity, and yet I had to weigh all the circumstances, and I knew that would not be a good thing for my parents. I reckon it wouldn't be a good thing for me because it wasn't where I had lived and grown up. See, I was an only child, as I mentioned earlier. I was at my daddy's elbow all the time, learning and taking things in. I knew all about nature. When we lived in Pryor, we backed up to maybe Pryor Creek, who knows, but a little creek ran through there. We had to walk through a pasture or two and navigate a couple of barbed wire fences, and I learned there that you would always throw a couple of pebbles in your front and in your path, and you would scare away any snakes or any critters or anything like that, you know, that would be in your path. We never killed anything in nature except for food. If we fished, we did not ever catch more than two or three fish because that's what we could eat for our meal that night. So I learned all those things that are still with me today.
Did Jack teach any males these dances?
Never. Never taught another soul.
So he and then you were the end of the knowledge of those dances?
Of that very dance. People still do them today. Several years ago, I went to a program at the library downtown here in Tulsa, and someone there was dancing similar.
Okay.
But the song has evolved. It's not the exact same song. The dance definitely has evolved. And now there are competitions, national competitions for dancing. In fact, just two or three years ago at Native American Day, I actually met one of the young men who had just won the national championship, you know, and he was eager to talk with me and to see me. And some of the things that we did that were so ultimately athletic, they don't do today. A lot of what they perform today is making symbols and designs with the hoops. We danced through them continually, the entire song. We were moving in and out. The hoops were moving in and out over our bodies. We were moving in and out, jumping through them, you know. So the whole, it is still, from a stamina point, I would say the hoop dance is very athletic, but it did not have the athleticism that our performances did. So all of this led Jack and myself to have, again, many opportunities. In fact, Jack was, when a still student at Bacon, was invited to perform before the Queen of England. And Bacon College asked if I could go, and my parents would not let me go. They felt like I would not have been chaperoned properly. It was going to be about a 2.5-week trip that would have taken me out of school partially. I would have had to miss a little bit of school. And so I didn't get to go on that trip, but Jack did. It was highly successful. Jack and I performed at the Bacon basketball games, and I'll never forget one night, one of the fellows couldn't come. Bill Garcia was sick, and he and Jack always did the shield dance. Well, the shield dance is a battle between two warriors, and they have their shields, they have their lances, and Jack came to me, and he said, "Winnie, do you think you could do the shield dance?" I said, "Well, I watch y'all do it, I know it, but should I do it, you know, because Jack's about 6'1", and here I am, barely 5 feet tall, you know. I thought, I don't know, we're liable to get in trouble." And he said, "No, Mr. West was the, Dick West was the, not chaperone, he was the, the director of that Indian club, and we had his approval." So I actually was in battle with my teacher there at the basketball game. So again, unbelievable opportunities. Jack had an older brother, Kenneth Ann Q, who actually started the Tulsa Powwow, and he had a troupe, and we would travel to several states, and I would always go with them, and we did a lot of dancing, scalp dance, buffalo dance, I mean squat dance, ruffle dance, snake dance. We had a whole repertoire of everything that we did. And again, what an exciting time for me, because I was doing the things that really led me and helped direct me to be the person that I am today. Might be hard for others to understand when you have a chance. To be a part of history, I didn't know it at the time. It was just what I chose and wanted to do. But it was an expression of creativity. It was expression of your culture and your heritage. It was a storytelling, a lifetime story of all of us have one, but where I had been and what I had an opportunity to do was extremely unique and at that even at that time was being recognized as groundbreaking. So all of this led to Marie Wadley, who worked at the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Muskogee, to invite me to be named Miss Cherokee. And I was to accompany our then principal chief, W.W. Keeler, to Sheridan, Wyoming for the All-American Indian Days, and Chief Keeler was named the Native American of the Year, and they wanted someone to go to participate in the Miss Indian America pageant, which was also in conjunction with that event. It was a week-long event, and I'm finding out now, even many people continue to say, oh my goodness, that was the biggest gathering of Natives anywhere. So my parents agreed, and my mother made, with my daddy's assistance to some degree, my Cherokee dresses for me to wear because it lasted a week. I needed three. We got it all pulled together pretty quickly. And what an amazing trip. I'll never forget. We left the old Tulsa International Airport, maybe not even international at that time, on the Phillips private plane. And I traveled with Judge N.B. Johnson. He was one of the judges of Cherokee Nation, with Earl Boyd Pierce, Cherokee official counsel, who was a friend of my father and I'd known all my life, Frank Muskrat, who was in charge of public relations at Phillips Petroleum. Of course, I failed to mention W.W. Keeler, our chief, was the head of Phillips Petroleum at that time. So what a trip for me. And really, Mr. Muskrat was my, he was in charge of me. So we arrive, and there are about 120 of us that are participating. And we're traveling, you know, several days have passed. We have had a series of interviews. We've had many things happening. And then they called me in singly, only me. And I realized there was some seriousness to the meeting. And I'm thinking, what is going on? And I was in my full dress and everything. We were getting ready to go to the rodeo that day, and we were all to appear there again, 120, 25 of us, and I'm singled out, and they asked me if I had been told prior to coming that I would be named the award winner, and I said, oh no, no one ever disclosed that. And so they asked me several other questions, and I think they realized that that was not so. But I could see, and I told Mr. Muskrat what had happened, and we realized then that because I had traveled with that huge entourage, well, not huge, but several gentlemen, the entourage from Phillips Petroleum in support of our principal chief, W.W. Keeler, that there could have been some kind of a, I don't know, some kind of a thought. I was singled out because many times they did not want me with, they didn't want me with the group. So they would have me sit with them. The group would be on one side of the aisle, and they would have me sit with them because Mr. Muskrat was so cautious that he took care of me. And that's the only thing that we could ever figure. Well, the bottom line is this. Dolores Jean Shorty, a absolutely gorgeous woman, young woman, who was Navajo, and she had the most beautiful, very simple dress, a velvet skirt, a velvet top, and a squash blossom necklace. And she was so striking. Different from the rest of us. She was chosen that year. Well, something happened, and she did not get to participate. And so, although I had been named fourth runner-up, I became third runner-up. So I guess you could say I was third runner-up to Miss Indian America. But what a wonderful, my goodness, a wonderful time for me. I have all kinds of photographs of that, of me with Chief Keeler. And, you know, the I have served on the board of the Cherokee National Historical Society as well as Cherokee Museum, and they have told me that my collection of photographs of our chief is almost more than what they actually have in their archives. So I have a scrapbook full of that trip. Again, another opportunity that just happened. It was because I was the one that was there. It could have been somebody else. But Marie Wadley had known me and watched me grow up there in Muskogee, and so I got the opportunity. So I married, raised two daughters, stayed at home the entire time, and raised them just as I had been raised. So they did not ever do specialty dances, but they certainly do, they dance, I'll put it that way. I have two granddaughters, and they both dance and have regalia to dance. And
how do they learn to dance today? Did you teach them?
Yes. Well, and you know, it's almost in your, it's in your nature. It's in your blood. It's there. You go to a dance. They've heard the songs always. I've always had tapes in the car and stuff, you know. And interesting enough, they all are singers. You know, so it's all very familiar to them. And when they were little, I know we once, my husband was with Shell Oil, we were transferred to Indianapolis, and they had a renowned children's museum there. And they invited me to dance, and they had a gathering of a few natives, but mostly Boy Scouts. And Boy Scouts scouting in those days, they studied Indian lore and dancing, of course. And so I agreed to go, and I was going to do eagle and hoop dance, but our oldest daughter Pam was about six, and she had a dress and everything, and so she performed the very first time with me there. So you see, when she was six, she began to hear those songs, and she was inclined that way anyway. Then our second daughter, well, she was only like 2 years old at that time, so she did not perform. But at many church functions, and you know, it's amazing how many people, I mean, I have an opportunity to speak to someone, to share stories. I'm a storyteller as well, to just recount my own journey, because it does have an element of uniqueness in it. And, you know, Gilchrist Museum had me speak, and they said that my story, you know, tells a story really of many that is early Indian country, you know, things that no one knows, and are being lost every day. So it has had a uniqueness, and my daughters embrace that very much and continue to dance with me. Both of my granddaughters have embraced that and are highly interested and want to know all that they can know. We all five of us, two daughters, two granddaughters, and myself traveled last year to Cherokee, North Carolina, and what an opportunity. You know, we were all overwhelmed to be there in our home country.
I bet. I haven't stopped there where it is, but to know that that's where you belonged.
Oh, my goodness. I had friends that I went to school with. I mentioned earlier I was a student at Northeastern in Tahlequah, and there were two sisters that had traveled here from Cherokee, and we stayed with them. They wanted us to come there for years, you know, ever since college days. And when I finally got there, I couldn't believe how emotional and powerful the experience was. We stayed a week, and I asked to go to their family burial grounds, you know, just on a mountain, the most gorgeous country you've ever seen. And to stand there, you were truly overwhelmed with the significance of it. We went to see Unto These Hills, which has been performed for, I don't know, 60, 70 years there. Since I was a child, I heard of it. And it was the most spiritual experience to stand there on that very ground. I was, I had a, well, we all, our whole family, they arranged for us to meet with the chief, Chief Sneed, and he was so wonderful to me and to us and welcomed us to his headquarters. We spent about 30 or 45 minutes chatting with him. And they all, of course, value and treasure the memory of Sequoia. So many people wanted to meet us and see us. And we went to the Cherokee elders dinner, which they provide every day for their elders. And probably 125 people there. Some of them came to me, and I dressed them briefly, and some of them came to me, and we realized that our parents, my daddy and their parents, had known each other either at Sequoia or at Haskell Institute. But, you know, it was that remarkable feeling of going home.
To clarify, the Eastern Cherokee, did they hide out so that they were not...
Yes, that's exactly right. So my friends, Bertie and Uggs, their parents, and all their family had hidden there in the mountains. And that's where they have always stayed. That's where they've been all along. And their story is totally remarkable. I could take another hour to tell about them. I will tell you briefly. While I said, I want to see your church. I want to see where you all go to church. I want to see your, burial grounds, your cemeteries and all that. And, of course, that made them, that was emotional for them, too, for them to take me there. And they shared a story with me, like, okay, the two sisters are talking, and they're like, oh, but Bertie, don't you recall when they were not doing the right kinds of things around building the right kinds of things we wanted built around our church? So we just moved the church. Now think of that. So we saw first the location where their church had been standing all of their life, and then we went up the road about a mile and saw where they had relocated that church building. And you see, the Eastern Band is so small. See, there's few of them. And fortunately, they now have the casino there on their property, and all their original allotments are extremely valuable now, and they have all maintained theirs and kept them. So their family has been leaders in everything there. Ugg had been, the older sister had been instrumental in the veterans headquarters and a memorial with all the flags and all the state flags, Cherokee flags, you know. And Chief Sneed in our meeting actually said, you know, your friends are leaders here, and they have been instrumental in financially supporting these things, as well as doing fundraisers for others, and are highly regarded in this area. So once again, I just happened to be at Northeastern. We just happened to make friends. They just happened to invite me there, and I got to travel there with both my daughters and my granddaughters. And I will tell you, it was so significant with my granddaughters. One of them's a graduate of the University of Miami. The other one, Marymount College in New York City. Both, all of them are singers and performers and successful young women. And when we were, we had a rental car. We had flown into Asheville. And when we were leaving, the Okefenokee River runs right through that. And I had continued to think I wanted to go down there and walk in that stream. So we had time, and we stopped, and we all took off our shoes, and we walked in the stream holding hands together. You know, life brings so many powerful moments, and I have experienced so many of them. My opportunities have been so great. And I'm grateful for every bit of that. But that day I was grateful to the Creator. for bringing me to that spot and giving my children and my grandchildren an opportunity to experience something that we didn't dream would be such a powerful thing. So here we are, the Cherokee Nation. I have served them and been an ambassador my whole life. I've known every chief. They named me one of five women that changed the Cherokee world, along with, like I say, our chief Wilma Mankiller, the first female chief of a major Indian nation. Wonderful, successful person. Ross Swimmer is my friend. W.W. Keeler was my friend. To be recognized as having experienced true history, I now value so highly. I didn't know it at the time. I was just living my life. And to be recognized by my nation as an honored elder. I'm a board member emeritus of the Cherokee Historical Society Board, also Cherokee Historical Museum. And right now, I just got new information at the Cherokee holiday this past weekend that we are building, they're going to surpass everything, and I was at that final board meeting at the Cherokee Nation just about 6 weeks ago, and they asked me to speak a final thought. And we as Cherokee people have always risen to the occasion. We're 400,000 strong at this time. Honorable people, honor our elders. There is no place I go that people are not honoring me, helping me. And it's very moving at the Tulsa powwow. About 4 years ago, a young man, well, not a young man, but a man that was about probably 70 came up to me and said, "Are you Winnie Guest?" And I said, "I am." And he said, "Well, I'm Sonny Supernaw. We used to dance together." I was quite a bit older than he was at the time. He was just a little boy. And he said, "Will you come over here? I want you to meet my family." And I said, "Of course I would, you know," because I did remember him. He was probably about six or seven. And we went over. And, of course, at powwows, all the families sit together. And sometimes there could be a large family. And probably he was introducing me to his family, and there were probably 35 or 40 in that section in lawn chairs there. And after he said my name, he said, "I want you to stand." And his whole family stood, and they recognized me as being a groundbreaking dancer at the Tulsa powwow just a month ago. They interviewed me on television, and they wanted to know how I felt. And I said, you know, to be here. I was at the first Tulsa powwow. Jack and I performed at the very first one. This was the 71st year, anniversary year this year.
So it started, do you remember?
Oh, well, we'd have to do some math. Yeah, it might take us longer.
About 50 years.
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. And, oh no, longer than that. Yeah. So anyway, they asked me, the interviewer said, you know, "How do you feel being here? You were at the very first one, and now you're here, see?" And
oh,
I'm
yeah.
probably one of the last ones that has ever, that's been there, you know. I mean, the Tulsa Powwow organization recognized me as last living. I said, you know, it was so very powerful and moving. And it brought to me a celebration in my heart, but it also brought to me many nostalgic memories of all those that had gone before me. And you see, I sat with the Ankew family, and There were many A&Q brothers and sisters. Well, they're all gone. They were my peers. They're all gone. I'm the last living. And all the younger people would come up to me, and, you know, I'd say, oh, now who are you? And they'd say, oh, I wasn't born, but I just wanted to come and see you and talk with you. What an ultimate honor. So I'm very grateful to my parents who raised me in the fashion that they did, always a high expectation with the bar set extremely high. I have walked in two worlds my entire life. And my parents were instrumental in all of this, in keeping me on a path. My daddy and I would cook frog legs that we had gotten the frog earlier in the day in our backyard. And I was the head cheerleader of our school, Muskogee Central High. And yet, that evening, I was in my backyard cooking those frog legs that my daddy and I had gotten. I'm still walking in two worlds.
On the same day. Yeah.
So I would tell you, my journey has been unique in so many ways. And has afforded me opportunity after opportunity. The things that would come my way, I've had the support of so many who just gave me moral support, you know. There was never a task that I thought I couldn't manage. I have to tell you that I was always an athlete, and I traveled to the Senior Olympic Games and participated in the actual Olympic Stadium and competed in race walk. And so what a wonderful experience is that. I was named, I believe, in about 204, the Oklahoma Senior Athlete of the Year, because I had been so successful in race walk and a leg press specialist. And all of that is a, you know, I attribute to dancing and having that skill and maintaining good health practices, which were my parents' long suit, believe me. So all of those things were something that was my way of life. I had recently lunch with my, I have many elementary school friends that were all still friends, majority of them, again, from Muskogee, Indian or Cherokee. And many times, you know, when we get together, they will say, we didn't know that you were doing all that, but you know that walking in two worlds things. I lived two different things in going to perform and doing Native dances, performing my culture, clearly understanding Cherokee heritage, you know. And it wasn't something that just came up in natural conversation. So they're amazed at the things now that they're reading about me or seeing about me. You know, they were like, how could you have been doing all of that and yet a school leader, you know, and someone very active in just another school life, you know. So what a reward could that be, and what an amazing opportunity. I've always done a lot of volunteer work. I was a gilly at Gilcrease Museum until we closed to start the new museum, and had a wonderful day there once telling my journey. And everyone stood in recognition to just hear the story from that dust rising from a gravel road. when my daddy was a child that did not speak English. And to be carted away the following morning to be educated and to live his early life at an orphanage. And then become a translator for the VIA and to lead me, he and my mother, longtime school teacher, to lead me on a path, to set me on a journey that would be considered so unique and certainly to me so rewarding at this time. I mentioned, hopefully, I traveled with the University of Oklahoma, and we traveled to do the Searching for Sequoia documentary, and what amazing time that was. They called and later asked me to audition for a short movie that the Cherokee Nation was producing on Nanyahi. She was the beloved woman of the Cherokee Nation. And I thought, I need to do this, and I did. And I won the audition, and I won the role. So the movie of that same name is being seen everywhere, and it's on, you know, been on national television. And as a result of that, they had a stage play that they were producing at the Hard Rock, at the Cherokee Nation support. And they had the original Nanyahi actress age. And so a year ago, they thought, well, my goodness, that's not working well, and what we want to do is just have someone elderly do that. They asked me if I would do the role. I said, only if it's if I only have to memorize a bit. Well, of course, once I agreed, then I got my script, and I had to memorize a whole lot. I almost turned in the towel after about the first month, and I had never quit on anything. And I looked to my parents, and I thought, no. You must do this. I learned it, and I did, I think, at least a good enough job. They have invited me back, and we start rehearsals this next Monday. So I'll be portraying elderly Nanyahi in that theatrical production at the Hard Rock again. All of these things continue to come to me. And I had that warrior's mentality. And, you know, doing those dances that had traditionally always been done by men, I had that in my heart, and I knew that I could meet any challenge. And that, too, has directed so much of my life. And it has all served me very well, so here I am. Winnie Mae Guest Purdue, Cherokee citizen.